in this talk, I'm really giving a big picture portrait of forgiveness. I'm not so much talking about the language of love and how you can give your wife some beautiful flowers as an expression of your forgiveness and so on. It's not that kind of application. And in fact, a lot of these stories I'll be telling are graphic and horrible. But I figure if I deal with the worst kinds of examples in terms of human behaviour and how forgiveness works in those contexts, then we might be just better able to handle the small buffets that we have to deal with day by day in terms of interpersonal relationships and the need for reconciliation and forgiveness in those. I'm going to start with two real life stories, and they show us the vast difference between forgiveness declined and forgiveness offered. The first one is a story about forgiveness declined. And it's the story that comes from Simon Wiesenthal in his book called The Sunflower. It's the story of how he walked away and left a young SS trooper to die unforgiven when he was in the concentration camp at Mauthausen in Austria. The soldier lay dying from head wounds and begged Wiesenthal to forgive him. But as I said, Wiesenthal didn't. Wiesenthal was a young architect, and with the other Jews caught in Hitler's death machine, he had various responsibilities at the death camp. On a certain afternoon, he was given the job of cleaning out rubbish from an improvised hospital outside the camp where wounded German soldiers were trucked in from the Russian front. It was getting towards evening, and a nurse took him by the arm and brought him to the bedside of a boyish stormtrooper named Karl. His head was bandaged, he had pus-soaked bandages, and he was about to die. Karl grabbed Wiesenthal's wrist. He whispered that he had to talk to a Jew, any Jew, before he died, so he could confess some terrible things. And he went on to tell how he was stationed in a Russian village. His company had been ordered to take reprisals in the village. They packed a frame house with Jews, including many children. They poured gasoline on the floors, locked the doors, and set the house on fire. People near the windows jumped, and the SS soldiers shot them before they landed on the ground, shot the little children right along with the parents, appeared to be, and machine gunned them as they fell through the air. Karl finished, and he was weeping, and he begged Wiesenthal to forgive him. Wiesenthal had listened awestruck to everything that Karl had told him. He said nothing. Finally, he yanked his hand away and left Karl to die with his unforgivable sins unforgiven. Afterwards, Wiesenthal worried that maybe he had been wrong not to forgive a young man who'd begged for forgiveness on his deathbed. So at the very end of his story, he put this: "Was my silence at the bedside of the dying Nazi right or wrong? This was a profound moral question that challenges the conscience. What would you have done?" And the publishers of the book decided to actually ask some fairly prestigious people what they would have done. And the answers were almost universally that he'd done the right thing. You would have never been able to live with yourself had you had forgiven him. "I would have strangled him. We cannot forgive murderers. I believe you followed a proper and honest path." Forgiveness declined. Contrast this story: forgiveness offered. On the night of August 10th, 1969, Charles Manson's famous family of drugged fanatics broke into a Los Angeles home and murdered Rosemary and Lino LaBianca. They carved the word "war" with a knife on Lino Lee Bianca's body, scrawled on the wall in Lee Bianca's blood the words "death to pigs," and they also scrawled on the refrigerator door, again in blood, the words "Helter Skelter." And you know that's the famous Beatles song, which talked about some sort of impending chaos that was coming. Just the night before, they had murdered five other people, including the pregnant actress Sharon Tate, at her home in a glitzy area of Los Angeles. The Bianca's daughter, Susan Struthers, discovered her parents' mutilated bodies. She suffered a nervous breakdown and took a long time recovering. Meanwhile, Charles Tex Watson, the wildest, most brutal of the murderers, was having a spiritual experience of his own. Watson spent jail time in San Luis Obispo State Prison in California. There he was born again, became a believer. Quite extraordinary. After Struthers learned about Watson's conversion, she began to write anonymous letters to him. And then after a while, a year or so of writing letters to him, she travelled to the prison to meet the man who had so terribly murdered her parents. She found him. He looked clean, respectful, friendly. And after a few visits, she told them who she was, the daughter of the man and the woman whose blood was on his hands. Why did she go? Well, she wanted to find meaning in the chaos of what had happened. But Watson persuaded her of his sincerity, and she started to come out of the hatred, the spiral of despair that had sort of so paralysed her life for so long. And it went this far. In 1990, she appeared at a hearing of the parole board and made a plea for Watson's release. She said his remorse was real. She knew it in her heart. His conversion was sincere, and his character had totally changed. At the same trial was another witness. It was Patty Tate, the younger sister of Sharon Tate. And she did not come to plead for Watson. She came to demand that he be kept in prison until he died. And what she wanted was not the protection of the wider community if he was released. What she wanted, and she stated it, was retribution. Well, there it is. Forgiveness offered and forgiveness declined. And we've seen that some of the criticisms made of forgiveness by those distinguished men and women who had the appendix to Wiesenthal's book have some powerful things to say. I guess you can sort of sum up their objections this kind of way, that forgiveness glosses over the enormity of evil. It ignores just vengeance. It ignores the idea of our society being a kind of a tooth for a tooth society. We're upset over the smallest violations of our rights by others and we seek to redress them. That's how life is. So why should we forgive these people? Forgiveness is dishonest. We sweep terrible acts under the carpet, calling it forgiveness. Or we just tolerate spiteful and horrible behaviour because of our forgiveness. And it contradicts human nature. We want to get even, so why don't we just admit it? Well, there's some of the popular preconceptions about forgiveness. And I'm going to go through them and sort of expose them. Not in exactly the same way, but slightly differently worded. The first preconception is this, that in forgiving people, we are tolerating the wrong that this person did, and we excuse the person who did it. But I would say this, if we forgive, we are actually not tolerating the wrong that the person did or excusing the person who did it. Why would I say that? Because the very fact that Jesus had to pay the penalty for our rebellion against God by dying on the cross so that we might be forgiven demonstrates that God does not excuse lightly or ignore wrong done. Wrong is wrong, and the person who did it is wrong. The offender may well be forgiven, but he will still have to face justice, whether it's in the civil court or in front of the judgment of God. The second preconception is this, that if we forgive, we're taking off the edge of evil somehow. But again, I want to say that's not right. If we forgive, we are not taking the edge of the evil done to us. the reality is that when we forgive, we are being honest about what happened. Forgiveness looks at the incident full in the face. It acknowledges that it's wrong and it has no place in God's world. In forgiving, we let the offender off for our private demand of justice. Remember that one particular occasion in Matthew 18:22, Peter says to Jesus, you know, how many times should I forgive? Seven times. And we say, oh, come on, Peter, how pathetic. But actually, Peter was being incredibly perceptive, because the rabbis said, you're allowed to forgive a person up to three times, but on the fourth time, if he continues with his bad behaviour, you don't forgive them. So Peter has actually been extraordinarily generous in moving it up to seven. But of course, we know the answer. Peter, 70 times seven, Jesus says. You see, Jesus does not let us put a limit as far as the demand for private justice. We have to forgive beyond expectation. And we cannot invoke that justice has gone far enough and we will now not forgive. No, Jesus says to that one. So we do not deny the pain or the reality of the evil done to us, or the possibility that the person may have to go to court or indeed face the judgment in God's end time. What we are saying is that as far as we are concerned, the war is over. The person is forgiven. We adopt the approach of Sally Struthers, not the approach of the daughter of the Page family. And I'm not judging her in saying that. I understand why she'd say that. Thirdly, if we forgive, we're surrendering our rights to justice. But that's not true. We've already said that God will deal with issues of justice, and so will the courts in the present. The fourth approach might be to say that if we forgive, we're inviting the person to do it again to us. We're condoning bad behaviour and he'll hurt us once again. But again, that's not necessarily so. A wife abuser may be unconditionally forgiven by his partner, but because he is a violent abuser, she will not subject her children or herself to that anymore until there is godly repentance, until there is changed behaviour, and until there is perhaps some commitment to professional counselling. You see, reunion can only occur at the price of honesty and changed behaviour from both partners. So again, that popular preconception is just simply not right. The last one is that if a person is not repentant, we'll not forgive. But that's precisely the point about Jesus' death, isn't it? That while we were his enemies, Romans 5, 6 to 8, while we were sinners, while we were ungrateful, while we were unthankful, while we were spitting and reviling him, that was the time that he exercised grace to us. That was the time he forgave us. You see, if we don't forgive, the cycle of retaliation just keeps going on and on and on and on. And you only have to think of the endless ethnic wars that drag on for 15, 20, 70 years or so to understand that one. So we've dealt about some, in that long section, and it is a long section, on some preconceptions regarding forgiveness. Now what I want to do is to actually talk about the biblical teaching concerning forgiveness. So here I'm talking about God's radical forgiveness, and I'll be particularly focusing on Jesus and you'll find out the reason why. The first thing I want to say is that the Old Testament teaching centres on a forgiving God. And one of the most important texts in this regard is Exodus 36, 6 to 7. And I'm going to read it out to us. And I've got the wrong text. I can tell you what it says. It's the great text where it says that God is a compassionate and forgiving God. And then it goes on and says, yet his justice will be maintained to the third and the fourth generations. Fascinating text. Notice that God is a compassionate and forgiving God who overlooks our iniquities. And yet, the text tells us that there is a justice to God that will not go away, that will still visit on the third and the fourth generation the sins of the first generation. Now, this text is repeated in various ways in Numbers 14, 17 to 20, Psalm 86, 14, Psalm 103, 8 to 10, Psalm 145, 8 to 9. But notice that as much as the forgiveness of God is underlined, so is his justice. Even more revealing than that are a series of psalms known as imprecatory psalms. And what they do is this, is that they invoke curses or punishment against the enemies of the psalmist. Here are a few examples. Psalm 55, 15. Let death take my enemies by surprise. Let them go down alive to the grave. Psalm 58, 6. O God, break the teeth in their mouths. Psalm 69, 28. May they be blotted out of the book of life and not be listed with the righteous. Psalm 109, verse 9. May his children be fatherless and his wife a widow. Psalm 37, verse 9. How blessed will be the one who seizes your infants and dashes them against the rocks. These texts are not just vengeance calls for the psalmist defending himself. It is asking God as the just God to deal with the enemies who are opposing his cause. And yet there is not one prayer of forgiveness for these enemies in the Old Testament. There are some texts that talk about God's unconditional forgiveness in the New Covenant. Ezekiel 16, 16 to 33, for example. Jeremiah 31, 31, 33 and 34. And we certainly learn about forgiveness offered through the suffering servant of Isaiah in Isaiah 53. But apart from books like Jonah, where God shows mercy over against his prophet, to the despised Ninevites, there is nothing, nothing like Jesus' love for the enemy in the New Testament. Let's now turn to Luke 6, 32 to 36. Luke 6, 32 to 36. There we read the following. And if you love those who love you, what credit, what grace, what charis, that's the Greek, is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit, what charis, what grace is that to you? For even sinners will do the same thing. And if you lend to those whom you expect to receive, what credit, what charis, what grace is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners in order to receive back the same amount. But love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High. For he himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful." This is an extraordinary passage because Jesus is dealing with the payback system of the ancient world. The payback system operated this way. You gave a gift, you got a gift back. A benefactor gave an aqueduct to a city. The city would return him all kinds of honours. They put up a statue, an inscription praising him. He would, of course, be the first in all the processions to receive food. He, of course, would have a seat at the theatre and so on. That's how it worked. Jesus says, love your enemies, attitudinal, do good to them, and by that he means act as a benefactor towards your enemies. So treat them like the benefactor treats the city, that kind of generosity. And lend, expecting no return. See, this is absolute foolishness. In the payback system, benefactors studied very carefully who you gave gifts to. Now, if I was a benefactor, I'd very obviously choose Paul because he is a very reliable person and he'd return the gift. But Mark over there, who I know very well and know what his character is really like, I wouldn't give him a gift for quiz because he's unreliable. Sorry, Mark, you're a nice, gorgeous guy. I understand that. That's why Louise married you. But you can see the point. You study very carefully the character of the person that you give, because if they do not return you honour and the gift, you are in massive shame control. Jesus says, Mark is the person you choose, because he's going to spit in your face, he's going to revile your gift, he's going to sneer at you, he's still going to hate you even afterwards. That's who you give the gift to. And you don't even get any reward. You'll be called sons of God in heaven, not in the present. So the reward is postponed. You see, Jesus has absolutely shot apart the benefaction system. He has brought in a new understanding of credit, a new understanding of charis, a new understanding of grace here. And grace is exercised to the enemy. Now, what's the motivation for this? Well, it comes out in the text. You can see it so clearly. Notice what Jesus says. It's all about how God operates. For he himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. You and me. God is impartial. He makes his rain to fall on the good and the bad, the just and the unjust. God is kind. And God is merciful. Be merciful as your Father is merciful. Now, it's a wonderful word. It's the God of the covenant who exercises mercy to his people. That's what we show our forgiveness to be consisting of, that kind of divine mercy. But in the context that Paul was writing to, Greco-Roman hearers listening to this gospel for the first time would have said, that's crazy. That's foolishness. Mercy was despised in the ancient world. Nero, for example, decided to set Greece free in AD 67. He was going to give them freedom from taxation. I mean, what a boon. And he said to them, it's not out of mercy, eleos, the word that is translated in the Greek Old Testament for mercy in the Hebrew version of the Old Testament. It's not out of mercy I'm doing this, it's out of goodwill. And he explains what he means by that. He's paying back the generosity of the Greek gods and the generosity of the Greek world to him. They just love him. You see, mercy was despised. Mercy is an emotion like compassion or empathy or whatever, and they're unreliable. You start to lose control of your reason. You start to treat Mark as you do Paul. And that's foolishness, because Paul is so much more reliable than Mark. And your emotion sways you away from sensible decisions. But that's how God works. He gives his grace to the unworthy, to those who don't deserve mercy, to those who are totally ungrateful, to those who despise and hate him. And we are to be the same, Jesus says. And then we have the saying on the cross. Luke 23, verse 34. An astonishing saying. Similar in many respects to what he's just taught. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they are doing. Notice the empathy of Jesus here on the cross. They know not what they do. They're blinded by their sin. They are blinded, of course, in the case of the Romans, because they do not know the God of Israel. They're blinded in the case of the Jewish authorities because they are so hard-hearted against God. But also it reflects, I think, God's concern for the Ninevites. Shall I not have mercy on this city and its people who do not even know their right hand from their left, and their animals as well? They know not what they do. But more importantly, notice Jesus' prayer for the enemy. Brothers, this is unprecedented in antiquity. I did a lot of research on this recently, and it's just been confirmed by a book that's come out by J.P. Meyer. And he's done it more exhaustively than me. And he has been able to turn up no saying in the Jewish literature or the Greek or Roman literature where someone actually prays forgiveness for the enemy. We've already seen, haven't we, the imprecatory Psalms, where you call down God's justice on those who are opposing the psalmist. So there's the standpoint of the Old Testament. What about the Dead Sea Scrolls? How about this one? Be cursed in all the works of our guilty wickedness. May God make you an object of terror by the hands of all the avengers of vengeance. Be cursed without mercy according to the darkness of your works. Be damned in the place of everlasting fire. Wouldn't want to be an enemy of the Dead Sea Scrolls, people. The popular proverb, help friends, harm enemies. That's how Greeks and Romans operated. And then you have the more philosophical discussion of Seneca, who says, how do you handle, like Jesus, for example, insults and injuries on the cross? And Seneca tells us, but, you ask, if a wise man receives a blow, what shall he do? If a Jewish rabbi is crucified on the cross, Jim Harrison speaking here, what shall he do? This is what Seneca would say should happen. What Cato did when he was struck in the face, he did not flare up. He did not avenge the wrong. He did not even forgive it. Hear that? He did not even forgive it. But he said no wrong had been done. He pretended it didn't happen. He showed finer spirit in not acknowledging it than if he had forgiven it. Wow. Absorb the hurt. Absorb the hard words. Just lock it all in. Don't let them see anything happening at all. It is all just absorbed, and you certainly don't pray for them, and you don't pardon them. Jesus has said something extraordinary here, something unprecedented in antiquity. We now just move towards the path of forgiveness. And I do want to say just a few words about how we move along the path of forgiveness. I just want to say that there are four positive things, four helpful attitudes that we can actually adopt to help us in forgiveness. The first one is empathy. It allows a person to see the enemy in a new light. He's a person loved by God. He's made in the image of God. He's a person with flaws like you or me. He's a person who must be forgiven no matter what. Remember in the parable of the prodigal son, the father sees the son in the distance and has compassion for him. And then he does what's unprecedented in the ancient Near Eastern culture. He runs towards the son in an undignified way. Fathers do not run in the Near East. And then he embraced him and kissed him, violating, of course, all the purity laws, because this son had been working with pigs, eating their pods. And he forgives them without the son even having the chance to say, excuse me, I'm a sinner, I've done something wrong here, Dad. He's forgiven before the son can blurt out a word. Extraordinary. Empathy. That's what God's like. The second character that helps us on the way to forgiveness is humility. We have to realise we're equally flawed and broken as our enemy. We deserve God's punishment as much as he does, indeed, perhaps even more. And that deep down, we're perhaps a lot worse. You know the pride of the Pharisee in the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. Thank you, God, I'm not like the other people, swindlers, unjust, adulterers, even like this tax collector. And he stands apart from the rest as he prays this prayer. And the tax collector is at the very back of the temple and he says, God, be merciful to me. Please forgive me for the sinner that I am. He will be able to forgive. The Pharisee will never be able to forgive. Thirdly, an obedient spirit to God is an important trait in the forgiving person. Remember the parable of the two sons. One son says to the father, yes, I'll work in the vineyard, and doesn't. The other son says, no, I'm not going to work in the vineyard, and does. And he's the one who goes away justified. Corrie ten Boom understood perfectly the power of forgiveness. After giving one of her talks, she saw this man coming towards her. And instead of seeing the man in the suit, she saw her old prison guard from Ravensbrook. And this is how it goes. You mentioned Ravensbrook in your talk. He was saying, oh, I was a guard there. Corrie says, no, he did not remember me. But since that time, he went on, I've become a Christian. You know that God has forgiven me for the cruel things I did there, but I'd like to hear it from your lips as well. Fraulein, the hand comes out, will you forgive me? I stood there, I whose sins had every day been forgiven and could not. Betsy, her sister, had died in that place. Could he erase her slow, terrible death for the asking? It could not have been many seconds that he stood there, hand held out, but to me it almost seemed as hours. I wrestled with the most difficult thing I had ever to do, for I had to do it. I knew that the message that God forgives is a prior condition, that we forgive those who have injured us. If you do not forgive men their trespasses, Jesus says, neither will your Father in heaven forgive your trespasses. And I stood there with the coldness clutching my heart. But forgiveness is not an emotion. I knew that too. Forgiveness is an act of the will, obedience. And the will can function regarding the temperature of the heart. Jesus, help me, I prayed. Notice the prayer. I can lift my hand. I can do that much. You supply the feeling. And so woodenly, mechanically, I thrust my hand into the one stretched out to me. And as I did, an incredible thing took place. The current started in my shoulder, raced down my arm, sprung into our joined hands. And then this healing warmth seemed to flood my whole being, bringing tears to my eyes. I forgive you, brother, I cried with all my heart. For a long time we grasped each other's hands, the former guard and the former prisoner. I had never known God's love as intensely as I did then. Obedience. An obedient spirit to God is an important character trait of the forgiving person. And lastly, divine grace produces a gracious character that forgives. You know the story, don't you, in the parable of the unforgiving servant in Matthew 18, 21 to 35. The king forgives his servant an enormous debt. 10,000 talents, that equals 10 million in silver content. But then the servant hypocritically goes out and throttles a guy who owes him a measly 100 denarii. That's 18 cents in silver content. You see, grace received from God means grace being offered to us, being offered to others through us. See, it's worth remembering in all this that the Spirit of God sheds into our lives, Romans 5:5, the love of God, so we can love the unlovely. And we have that internal capacity to do that because of Christ dwelling in us. My last section, very briefly and quickly, is on how do I forgive the God that hurts me? Most of us move on through these issues, trusting in God's goodness to us in the past, with the result we will expect that things will get better. Or we remind ourselves that God is sovereign and that all issues are under his control, even this one. Or the event becomes an invitation to humility before the awesomeness of a holy God. We learn to trust him more. Or our understanding of God expands. He's not just a dispenser of prosperity, but also he orchestrates the hard times in our lives. And so it goes on. But that's not the case for all people. Some people go through this type of learning, but others don't. They stall on their tracks. They just simply roll up in pain. They shake their fist in God's face. And in some cases, they abandon their faith. And the problem is with this, is that their life goes on automatic pilot. They cannot extend forgiveness to the human perpetrators of the evil because their problem with God is so great who has abandoned them in the first place. Now, I'm going to give you an example of this. When you go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., you eventually come to the boxcars that transport the Jews to the various concentration camps. And then you go past that and you see all the mud-caked shoes that the Jews stripped off before they went into the gas chambers. And then I saw on the wall this quote, and it was the thing that above all just jumped out of me in the whole exhibition. And it was a quote from Elie Wiesel, a Jew. And this is what she says. Never shall I forget that night, the first night in camp, which has turned my life into one long night, seven times cursed and seven times healed. Never shall I forget that smoke. Never shall I forget the little faces of the children whose bodies I saw turned into wreaths of smoke beneath a silent blue sky. Never shall I forget those flames which consumed my faith forever. Never I shall forget that nocturnal silence which deprived me for all eternity of the desire to live. Never shall I forget those moments which murdered my God and my soul and turned my dreams to dust. Never shall I forget these things if I am condemned to live as long as God himself. Never. Oh, how do you answer such pain? How do you answer my friend, a female, who told me that she'd been regularly raped by her father as a child for several years? He'd come into her bedroom late at night and she was trapped. She could do nothing. She was 8 when it started. And why did God allow this to happen? And why did God just sit by idly? How could she ever forgive the perpetrator of such evils, her father and her God? Well, I had no answer. But I didn't have to come up with an answer, because this is what she said to me. One day, I realized that my situation was the same as Jesus on the cross. He could do absolutely nothing about it. He was nailed there, and he was abused by his tormentors for me. He could have called his angels to release him, but he didn't. Instead, he remained there, trapped and victimized for my sake. I realized this, the long and difficult process of healing for me started to begin. You see, the gospel states that God is our fellow sufferer. God chose to turn his back on his perfect son, who he'd loved from eternity. He forsook him. He cursed him on his cross for us. His son screamed out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus experienced the inconceivable and hitherto unknown experience in his case of being cut off from God for the first time in eternity for us. He absorbed the deepest pain and unjustified suffering for the vilest of offenders, us, and he continued to love us anyway. This is a different God to the indifferent God of Elie Wiesel. Without the cross, she would be right in her assessment about God. With the cross, the story is entirely different. Amen.